On today's podcast, it's a new episode of Pass the Amyl as Garth Jones and I look back at the Aussie classic film Don's Party. My name is Justin Hamilton and you're listening to Big Squid. Hello, and thank you very much for joining us today. This podcast was supposed to be released yesterday, but for people on the Patreon, you would have received a work in progress episode on Monday. I'd been working on a new short story for the anthology series that we started on this podcast called Beautiful Tales for the Disenchanted. The next story was bubbling along nicely, and then, as you know, I ended up getting COVID, and I've been trying to kind of get back on track. I lost about a week and a half of work time, and you know what it's like. Once you get out of rhythm, it's really hard to get back on track in some cases. So I was trying to get the sense of that story back in my head, and we did a work in progress episode. And what was great about it is sometimes when you read a story out loud, that's when you start to pick up on the beats or the theme or something that you're missing. And so I knew there was something. I couldn't work it out. And then it clicked. And then I was caught up in a whirl of creative energy. And then it was like, holy shit, it's Wednesday afternoon. This podcast meant to have been out for like 36 hours by now. But anyway, here we are. And that is what counts. Before we get into it, for Adelaide listeners, I'll be performing at the Rhino Room for the first time in 18 months. Goodness. It's been a long time. Like, it's been a really long time. So I will be in Adelaide on June 3rd. I'll be performing at the Rhino Room with a few of the local acts. And if you'd like to come and see me in the human flesh, head to adelaidecomedy.com. And as a loyal listener of this podcast, make certain you get the Big Squid discount. Just put in HAMMO, H-A-M-M-O, and you'll have some money knocked off the price of your ticket. So that's just Adelaide Comedy and my way of saying thank you for listening to the podcast. And yeah, please come down. Also, I'll leave it brief here at the top. So, you know, sometimes I get right into chatting to you and then it's like, oh, was that the podcast? Oh, no, we still have the podcast to come. But just a reminder that Garth Jones' Cheaper Skits book is now available online. It's selling incredibly well and it's also receiving some fantastic reviews. And that's the double, right? That's the double right there. So what I'll do is I'll link the site on the Big Squid Facebook page so you can check it out. And that is... gives you an opportunity to get your grubby little hands on the book. And if you're enjoying our Ausploitation discussions, then this book will be for you. Speaking of Ausploitation, this movie doesn't really technically fall under that banner, but with an Australian election looming, we figured this was a good time to talk about this film. Actually, while I think of it, a reminder that you can vote early. I've already cast my ballot because I'm at a wedding on the day of the election. So if you're worried about COVID or you have something booked on the day, get down there now and you can vote and have it all sorted. Also, with that in mind, there's a bit of politics discussed in this podcast. Just to give you a sense of where we're at, we recorded this late last week. So the news about Roe versus Wade was just breaking in the States, and that is discussed. And it might seem weird to be talking about something that's happening in America, but certain aspects of Australian politics can follow a trend, hence why we discuss it here. Be prepared. Two old school lefties being furious. Still funny, though. I'll be honest, anyone who comes to the... gig at the Rhino Room in Adelaide will probably... let me put it this way. This discussion got some thoughts rolling that I might like to play around with more. So there you go. Okay, now it's time to catch up with Don and Kath Henderson as they invite their friends over for drinks to celebrate the impending victory of the Australian Labor Party. Unfortunately, it soon becomes apparent that they're not going to win, and as everyone begins to drink heavily, revelations and realizations suggest their lives might not be quite what they seem. You're invited, and make sure you bring your own beer and some snacks. Because we're heading over to Don's party.
Mal came, and Jenny. Simon and Jody. Evan and Kerry. Cooley, Susan and Mac. The host and hostess.
You're the one who throws these bloody parties. Dirty bugger!
No, no, actually, to be more accurate, it was more of a dribble. Well, because I'd been tasting wine and eating cheese for days, the old sphincters didn't have anything solid to come to grips with.
Let's face it, if you had to choose between me and that fat-stomached, melon-breasted tart out there, who'd it be?
Like to be in your shoes if you hit me. I'm a lawyer. I'll sue you for assault.
I'm gonna smash your bloody teeth in.
He's a dentist.
It was election day, 1969. Whatever their differences, Don's friends shared similar political beliefs.
Why don't you go live in Russia?
Why don't you go and...
Or most of them.
You don't know what you're fucking talking about!
What is Cooley like in bed?
Well, he's not all that big, but he's energetic for his age and inventive.
Don't take this as an insult, though. But you are a weak turd.
Hey, everybody, this is Evan and Kerry. That's Mac, Mal, Jody, Simon.
Don's party. What a night.
So we were going to record this a few weeks ago, and we planned on not only talking about Don's party, but talking about where the election was at in Australia. And then one of us got COVID, and that was me. And so we... Thank you very much. Good times. Right. Great rock and roll. Yep. And so with the recording today, which is the 4th of May, very important date for Star Wars fans. And it's kind of not a bad time to come back to Don's party, is it? Because we've had a little bit more of the election. And can I share with you the thing that's driving me the most nuts is commentators... And hosts of TV shows who just can't let go of a gaffe like Albo forgetting, you know, the unemployment numbers. And it's one of those things where I feel like saying to every one of those assholes, A, we forget shit all the time. Like, the amount of times that I stare at a password that I need to use that I cannot remember that I've used stacks of heaps of times, that happens just about every day. The amount of times that I'm talking about a movie I love and then you're suddenly going, oh my God, what's the shit, what's her name? Oh, Anne Hathaway. That doesn't mean I don't love Interstellar. It just means I forgot who Anne Hathaway was for a second. That's all that happened there. But it just seems we're more concerned with these ticky touchwood, who gives a shit fucking narratives rather than the fact that we have a prime minister who's a liar, who speaks in tongues to someone who doesn't exist and has no interest in doing anything other than remaining where he is rather than doing what he's meant to do, which is govern for the people.
He is super excited in that speaking to people who don't exist. He's gotten his plague, fire, flood in the last couple of years. Going great for him.
Mate, he must be... This is a crazy evangelist's wet dream. You must just be...
Pumped. Totally pumped.
And pumped is the right word. Every day you must be getting up and we're going to need a new box of tissues, honey. It's a great day for the end of the world.
Oh, there's an image for you straight away.
Yeah, I'm so sorry.
They further to, you know, the last few election cycles we've seen, obviously, like the advent of like Twitter and TikTok and everything becoming more and more prevalent in how they communicate with us, the punters.
Yeah.
I was listening to someone talk the other day about the fact that Joe Biden's actually got a TikTok advisor now that teaches part of that, you know, the inner circle.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, and we're down to, we've had most of our legacy media sort of whittled away into complete obsolescence now.
Yeah.
And yeah, they just give a shit about like that soundbite, that, you know, day-to-day gotcha thing. Or even if, I mean, it's obvious that, you know, whether it's Murdoch or Kerry Stokes or any of the other owners of our media in the country, they all clearly would prefer that the Liberal Party stayed in power.
Yeah.
So even if Albo doesn't fuck up, they still manage to frame whatever he does.
Yeah.
You know, like the other day there was his tweeted photo, which was apparently a campaign blunder because his dog had his phone number on it.
Right.
And that was the headline.
Yeah.
Albo's, you know, latest blunder. And it's just like, Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
Whereas, you know, the Prime Minister ends up on half a dozen different radio shows trying to convince us that he cooked his chicken properly.
Oh, my Lord. Like,
the
stuff, Jesus.
You know, that means a lot to, you know, mainstream Australia, the battlers, the.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just insane.
Oh, man. And, you know, we've had the RBA rates, you know, go up, which is, you know, for people who are making ends meet. Like, once again, I always get frustrated because for a long time, we think that the argument is, you know, racism or homophobia or all sorts of things. And I'm not saying that they are not problems, but I think the overriding issue is class, and it's the rich constantly moving forward and the poor struggling more and more, or not even the poor, the people who are just, you know, keeping shit together.
Yeah. I mean, happy to say that, like, well, I've been living in, like, for the last 2 months in Auckland, and,
You know,
it's a fast forward for everyone who's just getting their heads around the interest rate rises and everything in Australia, because the cost of living here is utterly bonkers.
Oh, yeah, Auckland is,
and, you know,
full on.
You know, as much as, you know, New Zealand is potentially a, you know, billionaire climate paradise for now, if you're, you know, under probably, I'm going to say even 50 now, like, yeah, you're going to be very lucky to be able to afford a house that you don't buy with at least three or four other families.
Yeah.
You know, a very basic supermarket shop will set you back $300.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, price of petrol, every sort of aspect of living here is just mind-blowingly ridiculously expensive unless you own multiple rental properties and, you know, cashing in at this point.
I probably spend about between $100 and $120 a week on grocery shopping.
Mm.
And I live by myself. And I don't, you know, like, that's not snacks. That's not a lot of fun stuff. That is the basics. I wrote a blog a few weeks ago about I got a cauliflower when you go through, because I was, to be honest, I was listening to a podcast while I was putting it through the counter by myself, you know, and then you get home and it's like, geez, that was an expensive shop and I didn't really buy that much stuff. And I was going through and I saw I'd spent $9.90 on a cauliflower and it was like, do I eat this or do I adopt it? Like, that's a lot, you know.
Could have bronzed it.
Could have bronzed it, yeah. It's crazy. So then I think about a family of four.
I saw a $12 punnet of blueberries yesterday. You know, not to get into the full, you know, consumer price index thing, but yeah, it's just everything is excruciatingly, you know, painful, and it's, you know, people's diets obviously end up, you know, at a micro level affecting the health system because people start going to the Macca's drive-through.
Yes.
And eating processed food, and then you know, all of those outcomes in terms of, you know, people having no money.
Yeah,
eating badly, you know, health systems, all the rest. As you say, it's just like anyone who's ahead is going to stay ahead.
Yeah,
and everyone else can go get fucked.
yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? You know, I don't know if you had an opportunity to see it, but the new premier for South Australia, Peter Malinauskas, his acceptance speech on the day of the election was by far the most inspiring speech by an Australian politician that I've seen in decades. It was so beautiful and it had grace. He, you know, he was very generous towards the Liberal Party, talking about how it's important that they're there because they helped define the Labour Party. And he pointed out to everyone that, you know, people have lost their jobs today. There are families who now don't have jobs and we have to take them into consideration. And then he, you know, once he, and he spent a long time making sure that everyone kind of knew what the rate of contrition was in this situation, and then the rest of the speech was incredibly inspiring. And then you just kind of talk to people and they say, yeah, didn't he forget to thank his wife? And you're like, that was said to me so many times by people, and it's like, yeah, but like, A, I don't really know, and B, it was a beautiful speech. Like, can't we,
focus on that? Yeah. I mean, but yeah, you just, it's got to be the, I mean, at the end of the day now, you know, it's very rare that anyone's going to like any individual politician. It's sort of the blanket now is that, like, you know, they're all pricks.
Yeah.
Which has been very much earned at a federal level, I guess.
Well, yeah, if they're going to keep pitching.
But, yeah, you know, like maybe at the state level there's a little bit more sort of engagement with the communities and, you know, the people they're actually supposed to be serving, not screwing.
Yeah.
What a concept. Yeah.
What a concept. Well, we should talk about this movie. It's a very political film, Don's Party, a fascinating movie that requires kind of a specific viewpoint when you're viewing it. And that viewpoint is you have to watch it through the lens of the early 70s along with the way society is today. And I'm curious because I really enjoyed rewatching it, but it was tricky. And what was the trickiest part of rewatching this film for you?
I've been thinking about this and probably a lot of the listeners will be familiar with The Late Show.
Yeah.
And probably remember what I thought at the time was a satire.
Right.
Of Don's Party called Ron's Barney.
Yeah.
That actually was just pretty much 100% straight adaptation of the film. Maybe just, you know, just obviously compressed for time and everything, but like pretty much ticks all the boxes of homophobia, sexism, the intellectual classes scorn for the proles.
Yeah.
Everything's in there in with a fight and wasn't as much nudity probably.
No, that's about the one thing that they didn't get to.
Yeah. But yeah, exactly.
If that sketch went for another 15 seconds, they could have thrown in some random boobs and then it would have been a perfect reenactment.
Absolutely. But yeah, I guess, you know, all those, well, it's set in 1969, written in the early 70s as a stage play, and it ticks a lot of boxes that you just, you know, that stuff is, although, you know the content of the film and what's coming most likely if you've, you know, been aware of the, you know, in the culture. But yeah, the first homo and poofter and all that sort of stuff is still extremely jarring.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's funny, all of that stuff was the same for me. I found pretty much every man in this movie to be awful in some way. And they kind of reminded me a little bit of the men that intimidated me as a kid because, you know, being raised by a single mum, I didn't have those kinds of men around me that often. We would have family relations that would turn up now and again, and it would always be, you know, heavy drinking, all a little bit aggressive. You know, friends of dads of other friends and that kind of stuff was always, you know, it always felt a little bit violent. And what I found about this to be really fascinating as well is even the so-called intellectuals are extremely aggressive. And I when I was watching it, when I say aggressive, I mean kind of they feel physically aggressive. Mm-hmm. And when I was watching it, it's jarring, but I feel like the satire still works because I don't think they're on their side. I think he is satirizing it, but I think it's not quite as
sharp. Knowing what we know now about the journalist and, you know, Labour Party firebrand, you know, the sort of hard drinking, sort of bare knuckling Bob Ellis.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd be surprised if, you know, a character in this wasn't a direct sort of comment on his behavior.
Yeah.
Even from that era precisely.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, the lechery, the, like, you know, snobbery, the whole sort of, you know, and he, you know, as a beloved Labour icon that later you discover as a animal in a lot of senses. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess there's, yeah, that aspect too. Like they are looking pretty intensely at what the sort of party animals literally and figuratively behave like.
Yeah, yeah, it's so funny. Like it's the woman who voted Liberal who I think comes across as in many ways the nicest. You know, like the most fair, you know.
It's just easy to vote for the Liberals. I don't have to think about it.
Yeah.
It's still fine.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's not being an arsehole towards everybody. Yeah. To give our listeners some background, if they haven't seen this before, as Garth already mentioned, the film is set on October 25th, 1969, with John Gorton's Liberal Party going head-to-head with Gough Whitlam's Labor Party. Gorton was considered an average Aussie bloke, while Whitlam had reformed the Labor Party, abandoning the White Australia policy and the commitment to socialism. The White Australia policy, still going strong in...
Indigenous people only got the vote, like, in that, you know, maybe 18 months before that.
Yeah, crazy. Like, just
and I guess I'll just quickly interject as well for anyone that's listening outside of Australia, Liberal means conservative.
Yes.
And yes. Labor Party is the equivalent of, like, the English Labor Party or, sadly, you know, more and more the Democrats in the United States.
Well, they're the idea of the Democrats.
Yeah, the concept.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing with Gough Whitlam was that he was able to win over new voters with a platform that included free university education and universal health insurance. Maybe our listeners in America have heard of this thing. You can get it here in Australia. And
We've got it.
It's quite good. It was a close election, with Whitlam missing out by 4 seats of toppling the coalition, which is pretty, like, it was a pretty hefty swing and it got so close. And in this movie, we have a 30-something couple, Don and Cathro, an election night party. Do you reckon this will be happening amongst the 30-somethings today, or is politics too damaged for the average punter to really have this type of passion?
I mean, everything I would, you know, register about 30-somethings, inverted commas, once was. Yeah. Very dimly now. I mean, I think the disaffection is so great that, you know, both major parties, I think, are so on the nose with them that if they do have some sort of situation happening, it'll be sort of probably popping a pill or something if the Greens hold the balance of power.
Right. Yeah.
You know, because I think that's the only way they're going to see any sort of structural or, you know, any policy change. They're going to really, it's going to feel like it's going to mean anything to them at this point.
And then, by the way, that's not a criticism of 30-somethings. I think it's a criticism of politics.
No, it's the system itself.
Why would they have any faith?
Yeah, I mean, everything I see that goes past on my, you know, very meme-friendly, Twitter accounts that are constantly having a crack at the drips, as they call the Labor supporters on Twitter.
Yeah,
they're just furious. And, or, you know, anyone on the sort of, like, further left than, like, you know, Albanese is just, like, gobsmacked by, you know, their lack of vision or attempts to, like, you know, do anything progressive.
Yeah, it's quite fascinating, isn't it? Because also you and I are much older than the characters in this movie. And I don't know about you, but I felt pretty good about myself physically looking at them. Much harder life back then, right?
Because, I mean, I think Graham Kennedy might have been, some of the situation going, you know, just amazing, isn't it? Like,
yeah.
I know it's haircuts. I know it's, like, you know, clothes, all the rest. But, yeah, you just look at previous, like, images from those eras of people your age or younger, and it's just like, wow, all right, that was, like, 4 packs of spikes a day. And
half a carton of beer every other day, you know.
And leaded petrol, basically. Inhaling leaded petrol and whatever else was going on.
Yeah. No one then had discovered the joys of being able to cook a nice grilled eggplant.
Yes. Yeah. I was reading a book by Jennifer Egan the other day, and she talks about, you know, guys from that era, you know, not being well versed with the idea of actual exercise, you know, exercise for personal well-being.
Yeah.
You know, you'd still take a pack of smokes with you.
Yeah. Look, I'm not saying everything's great now, but I will take diet. I will take diet.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. If you can afford to eat an eggplant.
Yeah. Get me wrong. It cost me $35 a week.
You never buy a home with that attitude.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's either leave a good-looking corpse in the place that I rent, or die of malnutrition in the place that I decide that I can theoretically afford. I'm fascinated that every couple in this party is antagonistic towards one another. And even though it's a satire, it's confronting to see how the women speak to the women and about the women. Yet, once again, it does feel satirical of those types of people and how it used to be, right?
Yeah. I mean, I was sort of like 7 or 8 during the early 80s. And I do remember sort of, you know, that sort of tension, I guess, like you talked about earlier with, you know, family, friends, or, you know, uncles and aunties who, they're never going to listen to this. My uncle and auntie were awful.
Right. Right.
You know, to each other, you know, would sit there and chain smoke and, you know, just tear strips off each other. And, you know, 40 years later, they're still doing it. Yeah. Bless them, though. They did let me watch Beneath the Planet of the Apes when I was 6. So, you know, it's not all bad.
Swings and roundabouts.
It's also, I guess, you know, people get married later now too, or they make those decisions.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess this film, or the play and the film, are sort of looking at couples who all got married when they were like 20.
Yeah, of course.
Have had a kid, have all bought into the dream, and have all they're all failures at 30.
Yeah.
Or like self-loathing and like haven't had that sort of opportunity to like sow their whatever oats, which obviously we're going to get to.
Right.
Because they're all desperately doing it in these like marital battlegrounds.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a really interesting point. They've, you know, they've already got 15 years of resentment
at
33.
And that's why they look like that.
Yeah, yeah. Suddenly it's all coming together. Yeah, it was funny. I was getting lots of flashbacks in that regard to that kind of time. And I found it really confronting. Not unenjoyable, but just, I remember that argument. Oh, I remember that couple. Oh, I remember the way he used to talk about her. Oh, I remember the way she used to talk about him and the way the kids would react off the back of it. It helped explain our generation a lot more to me as well. Like, you know, our rebellion against that generation was to be, you know, regardless of, I don't quite know where Gen X is at the moment. It's obviously the forgotten generation in many ways, but it did become more introspective, and it did become, some of the positives was it did try to find that middle ground of emotional, like it was the beginning of trying to find emotional stability.
You know, coming to being a dad at like, you know, 40 or whatever, you do have a lot more equipment there to emotionally.
Yeah.
And, you know, you've spent time reflecting on that stuff and not revisiting, you know, whatever terrible, you know, things you might, you know, remember from your childhood.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You've had time to remember processing it, learn from it, and reconcile it, which I think is the most important part, you know. Often it feels like a lot of the faults that these men and women inflicted upon their children was the fact that they were still angry about shit.
And they're just ill-prepared, you know, and, you know, obviously that's, you know, had a basis in, like, you know, their economic status as well in terms of, you know, I mean, that was probably the first generation that went to university in Don's party, you know, because they discuss, you know, they talk about their disaffection with how their lives turned out at 30.
Yeah.
But prior to that, it was like, you know, if you're not, haven't got 4 kids by the time you're 21, what are you doing?
What are you doing? Get on with it, for God's sakes.
I want to be a grandmother by 35. It's like,
Yeah, I want to be able to pick up all 4 of my grandchildren. It's very interesting to see this as the start of the baby boomer generation coming into play. There are a lot more left-wing in their politics, and the middle-class voters wanted to challenge the conservative Australian culture. Where's it all gone wrong? I don't want to get into boomer bashing. I don't know. I don't like that kind of stuff. But, you know, like as an example, like my mum is still savagely left wing, and she.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, you know, my
Yeah, she despises being lumped in with the baby boomer affectation. She's really angry about it. So.
And yeah, there's that. You know, there's that whole sort of the conventional wisdom. If you're not like a socialist when you're like 20.
Yeah.
You don't have a heart, and if you're not a capitalist by the time you're 40, you don't have a brain or whatever it is. It's like, you know, my great uncle's 87 and he's still got like his portraits of Lenin and Stalin in his living room.
Yeah.
And he's gotten, you know, I don't think the ABC vote compass would actually know what to do with him.
Right.
If he knew how to use a computer.
Yeah.
Probably Anthony Green's head would probably explode.
Yeah.
but yeah, what went wrong? What happened to Gough with the dismissal, which is probably too much to go into here, but, you know, that probably disaffected that generation even further.
Yeah.
And then basically the, you know, Reaganomics, neoliberalism, Thatcher, here it was sort of like, you know, that Liberal Party was still in power in the early 80s.
Yeah.
But, you know, Hawke and Keating, you know, and we know a little bit more about them behind the scenes now as well, but, you know, they still sort of put the neoliberal project in place, you know.
Yeah.
To a large extent. So, you know, I think, and then, you know, being born into it too. I voted first in 96 and that was John Howard.
Oh, yeah. 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 My first vote was for Keating when he won the election, and I was like,
fuck yeah,
how great is voting? This is the best.
Democracy works.
Yeah. And then I was sad for another 10 years.
Or well, you know, I can't remember the exact figures, but like since World War II, the Labor Party has been in power. The Labor Party has won from opposition three times.
Yeah.
In 70 years.
Yeah.
And in the last 30 years, they've been in power for 6 years.
Yeah.
So
that's great.
That at some point, if they'd maybe kept winning elections, maybe they would have kept, you know, we wouldn't have been hauled this far to the right.
Yeah.
But now the strategy seems like it is to be as
gently
targeted as possible. Yeah. And just sort of stick to them on everything they can and hope that, like, they just, you know, the personality stuff reigns.
Yeah.
And hopefully drags people along with it. It's nuts.
Well, I guess it's the, you know, because you're fighting so many battles. You're fighting the conservative press and the opposition, and the opposition is moving further and further to a place that feels very uncomfortable.
Yes, yes.
Like we're seeing in the States, there, you know, it looks like they're about to overturn Roe versus Wade. And I know that's in the States, but you have to watch that stuff because it empowers other governments around the world to go, we can do that now too.
You know, the Australia's always felt like, well, that's probably times, the period of time's probably compressed since we've had, like, you know, the internet and everything, but like Australia's always felt 15 to 20 years behind in terms of like where some of those social changes happened.
Yeah.
And sometimes very much ahead of it too. But like, yeah, I mean, considering the makeup of the Australian Liberal, you know, the Liberal National Party in terms of like which schools they went to and what their religious affiliations are. Yeah, absolutely. It's something that you can see them. It'd be dangerous, I think, still, because it's like we love our healthcare and we love, you know, all these rights we've got. But if they keep eroding it and just, you know, if there's no other voices talking about how lucky we are to have that stuff, eventually people will forget.
That's the problem. People forget the freedom that they have, and they take it for granted. Personally, I think if you're going to ban abortion and tell a woman that she doesn't have the right to be in charge of her own body, look, you have to go the full hog, and I think you have to ban wanking as well. I think a man's not allowed to jizz unless it's going into a woman to give her a baby, and if you catch a man having a wank, and unless that's going into a cup that can be used for pregnancy, then, you know, that guy should go to jail.
We need some sort of genetic tag or something that we can make sure all that stuff.
Yeah, I reckon from the age of 15, I reckon you should be allowed to have cops turn up randomly at your house and have your bed sheets checked. And if you've had a wet dream, you get a fine.
Open
for
up
your first
the
wet dream.
Inspector. Put that sock down.
Yeah. Turned out Monty Python was right. Every sperm is sacred. Man.
Put down that copy of Razzle.
Yeah, what are you doing with that, mate? No, I read it for the articles. No, you don't, mate. No, you don't.
Step away from the Vaseline.
Mate, I'm going to check
Vaseline all in the first place, for fuck's sake.
Don't use Vaseline, you crazy arsehole. And secondly, we have four gym socks here that we're going to use as prosecution, and we're going to put you away for 3 years for each gym sock that we find.
It's fair to me, yep.
We make jokes because it's better than crying.
It's, yeah, it's so, yeah, just heartbreaking. And, you know, it's obviously a, not that we'll get, you know, we're talking about Australian politics, but, you know, like, it's always targeted at people who don't have the means to just go and do it somewhere else.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's it, isn't it? Like, you know, the amount of fucking conservative motherfuckers who have voted against this kind of thing, who are sending their mistresses off to have abortions is...
daughters, mistresses, whatever, they could ship them off elsewhere and it's totally fine. But if you're a disadvantaged person, you're basically condemned, and the child might grow up in circumstances that, it's just, as I said, heartbreaking.
Yeah. The characters in this movie are fascinating because they really look down on anyone who flaunts their wealth. Do you remember that? That's such a really old school Aussie thing that I'd completely forgotten existed. And it's like, why buy a $60,000 home when a $40,000 home will be more than enough? Funny numbers to think about today. Even the dentist, Evan, might be uptight but declares he's a socialist dentist. People just don't talk like this anymore. Does anyone give a shit if you flaunt your wealth?
Well, wasn't it good when there was a tall poppy syndrome?
Right.
Everyone just kept pull their fucking heads in.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the aspirational Australian that we were raised to, or, you know, we began to see introduced, that probably then morphed into Howard's Battlers, who were the cashed up tradies. So get your boat in your yard, get your McMansion.
Yeah.
And it's not a judgment at all. No. Yeah, it's just we suddenly sort of pivoted to becoming like, you know, Brightons and basically attempting to be Beverly Hills. And everyone needs to know exactly how well off we are, or we have to promote it. Well, the status symbol thing.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. Like, even if you think about pop culture, who are some of the most favourite characters running around in movies?
Those billionaires, we love them.
Oh, mate, a billionaire in an iron suit, a billionaire who dresses up as a bat and beats up people in low socioeconomic situations.
They can help us out. We've got to aspire to be like that, although they, you know, inherited wealth from extremely dubious...
Right. You know. But they're the heroes.
Yeah, they're great. Elon's definitely the hero. He's...
Mate, like... Yeah, I was just talking to Will Anderson the other day when we were like, you know, Richard Branson is Tony Stark. you know, Elon Musk is Bruce Wayne, and Jeff Bezos is Lex Luthor. And that's what it looks like in the real world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and then you've got Bill Gates, who sort of actually did make it, you know, he did actually make his own money, but then fucking hanging out with Jeffrey Epstein anyway. So, you know, your moral compass gets blown up as soon as you hit your first billion, probably. And then once you're up to about your 170th, you're off on a different planet in terms of where your priorities or empathy is.
Yeah. I love that Elon Musk bought Twitter and, you know, wants to make it a better place and blah, blah, blah. You know what he could have done is he could have just given every American $3 million each and saved a lot of his money. And, the proviso is that you can't be an arsehole on Twitter, and that would have been...
Well, I think, you know, he did ask, you know, the World Health Organization to give him a study on, you know, how he could cure poverty, basically. $6 billion.
Yeah.
You know, clearly everything he does is just a publicity stunt to feed the whatever's going to happen next. But, I could feed them, or I could buy the platform where people are mean to me and, you know, assuage my sense of persecution, although I'm the wealthiest person in history. Who likes to post shitty memes and smoke weed and
be on the
timeline. Yeah.
Something else in this movie that was once again something that I had really not thought about in a very long time is the wife swapping aspect. It's really hard to grasp, but it was according to some research I did, this phenomenon was first seen in the Australian middle classes of the 60s as an opportunity to be free to new experiences. But I read a thing with David Williamson, the author of the play and the author of the movie. It soon wore off once women realised that this was just as oppressive as what had preceded it. Don't you think it looks like a very sad culture and thing to be a part of?
Pardon me. Yeah, I mean, it's like you know, these people clearly missed out on having a whole bunch of fun, and in the had to sort of devolve into this really sad, desperate sleazing onto every you know, person in a skirt that goes past, enters their orbit. Just, you know, sort of at once feigning impenetrable self-confidence and demonstrating just what a loser you are at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? It's but it really does get back to what you were saying before about, you know, being married for like 12 years by the time you're 30 and suddenly seem like great ideas.
Yeah, I think of family members who definitely got married, you know, in previous generations, who definitely got married at that age and then wouldn't have remarried after their partners died or whatever. And it's like, you know, you know, again, different economic and societal values at play. But, you know, I think, you know, that's one thing we can be grateful for, at least, is all that sort of life milestone stuff ironically got pushed back by the fact no one could afford to do it until they were in their late 30s.
That is
I can't do that. I can't buy a fucking house and have a kid and a car I'll just get wasted instead.
He's better.
Yeah, perfect. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. According to some historians and Williamson, the movie is much more brutal in tone than the play, which is interesting. Susan Binney, who played the university student Susan, said she still shudders when she recalls the filming of the pool scene where the men take her clothes off and throw her into the pool. Binney didn't know this was going to happen, and Williamson shared his disquiet over the scene. Is that one of the most aggressive slash technically harmless but awful scenes you've watched in a movie in a while?
It's a bizarre one, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because then we get to see, I think it's Graham Kennedy's nutsack, like, from underwater as well.
Yeah. Yeah. At least it's equal opportunity.
Absolutely, yeah.
I didn't need to see any of it.
But, the consent, the consent, all the aspects of it, yeah, definitely sort of flesh crawling as you sort of what, but yeah, as you say, it's really innocent too, although it's in front of all the wives.
Just
a choice. Yeah, I'm not sure what Bruce Beresford was angling at there.
So this is part of what I find interesting, because it is a satire, and like, he's a great director, so was he actually being a little bit ahead of the curve, and that is actually part of the satire, is showing how awful these people are? But then, you know, like, is it easy to kind of be a little bit dismissive of that scene and critical and kind of miss the point that it was being satirical and helping to point out how awful these guys are? Or am I giving it too much credit? Like, I don't really know the answer to that. I kind of, while I was watching it, I didn't like it, but I also felt like it was part of the sharpness of the satire.
Yeah, I guess, you know, it genuinely too, like, the exclusively female nudity up to that point is a lot more gratuitous than you would have got, you'd get, especially considering, you know, was it Curly, his girlfriend, again, inverted commas, she's, you know, 19. He's a guy and he's, you know, sleazy lawyer in his 30s who's, you know, using her for sex, and then, you know, everyone's allegedly cool with it. But yeah, just some, you know, those aspects, all the of the artist, I can't remember her name.
Keep talking, Jody. I'll look it up. Was it Jody? Yeah.
No, anyway, yeah, but you know, again, like, it's that sort of like, yeah, definite male gaze that gets sort of switched around in that scene a bit, I guess, although we're still sort of marveling at, like, all those 70s dude bods.
And they are definitely dude bods right there.
Oh, yeah. It sort of even, you know, the muff and dong situation was evened out a bit.
Yeah. Well, I'll give it that, at least. It's interesting. I guess if I read that she was across it, then I could absolutely safely say that it was 100% satire. Even if it is satirical, it's hard to feel comfortable with the way they went about doing it. But, you know, once again, not to make any excuses for anyone, but, you know, you hear the awful stories. I don't know if you've ever... I've never actually seen the movie, but you hear the awful stories of the way Dustin Hoffman treated Meryl Streep on the set of Kramer versus Kramer and the stuff that they would just... let these people get away with, or, you know, Marlon Brando and Last Tango in Paris. Jesus Christ, you know?
Yeah, just the abusive behaviour that sort of like for the art.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the overall intent, which is like, you know, using someone.
Yeah.
Using someone in a horrific moment.
Yeah, there's definitely progress in that regard, which, you know.
And Jared Leto, we're talking to you.
well...
Dr. Michael Morbius, asshole.
Oh, did he do anything for Morbius? Or I just know about
He actually pretend. Well, it was it was more just a blanket, extremely on the nose. He would turn up and insist on behaving like he was on set in character and would insist that he was disabled throughout the entire filming. So they'd yell cut, and it'd take like 45 minutes to go to the bathroom. Because he was in character.
Sorry, I just... man, didn't...
just like, fuck off.
You know, like, I love Daniel Day-Lewis, and I know that, you know, between takes when he was making My Left Foot, know, which some people would look upon as being extremely, you know, wrong now, but... you know, that's at least that's a movie that's trying to portray someone with a level of dignity, and you know, he's trying to understand that character. And the Dr. overall
Michael Morbius, the vampire, mate,
fucking
the human vampire,
mate. It's a fucking Sony movie.
Take it
down,
seriously. Mate. Take it seriously.
Just walk over and take a shit and come back, you crazy arsehole.
And then he sends the shit to a crew member, probably. But you know,
yeah, my
Lord. In character,
yeah. One, maybe my favourite line of the movie is when Jody, one of the only Liberal voters at the party, exclaims, "I don't think there's anything wrong with discussion, but you shouldn't argue with people you disagree with," which is, on the surface, a very funny line. But the more I thought about it, especially in the current climate, I felt like I agreed with her. Like, it feels like I would feel more comfortable arguing with you about something because we come from a very similar vantage point and we both want a similar outcome, but we just might... disagree on how you would get there, and then arguing with someone who has the complete opposite viewpoint feels like...
Well, I guess the contemporary version of that is just log off.
Just
log off. That's why you don't talk about politics on Twitter, because it's just like a sort of, you know, it's just a whirlpool of, you know, you're never going to get anywhere except, you know, indulge your own self-flagellation.
Oh, yeah. It's like people getting angry about stuff on, like, you know, not even important things, but getting angry about stuff on social media. I feel like it would be like me stopping a bus to get on and say, "I hate you because you've got fucking Shane Jacobson on the side of the bus. Fuck you." And then getting off the bus and the bus driver's like, "What?"
Well, I've got that off my chest anyway.
Yeah. Anyway, that's made a difference to the world. Yeah. Discussion, social media, like, I won't get involved in anything on social media, and rarely anyone arcs up in my direction about anything, but I just barely read what they're saying, and I just delete and block, you know, and I just kind of move forward. I don't mind someone pointing out something and saying, "Hey, I thought about this," or "I thought about that," but, you know, invariably the people who are really measured online are the people who are invariably Patreon supporters, so they're already on board with discussion. Exactly, yeah. You know, yeah. They're great.
There's very active contingents on across all of those things. They're looking for, they're spoiling for it. And you know, that's, I guess, as Don and the rest of the lads get increasingly more pissed and despondent as the election call comes in. That's all they've got left, and that may be what, you know, people nominally left of centre are doing at the moment.
Yeah.
Preparing himself for another disappointment. I don't know.
Yeah, I know I am. But the two main culprits are Don and Mal, who are men who have eased into this, like what they consider middle age, but is still young men when you look back at it. And they're kind of ignoring the fact that they never followed their dreams. And they're fascinating, aren't they? Because it's like, in a weird way, even though they intellectually, follow the Labour Party and do want this reform, there's this, I don't know, it's sort of like they're still chasing the romantic ideal that if the Labour Party gets in, their fortunes are about to change and they'll suddenly write that novel they were always meant to write, etc.
I guess, yeah, sort of like, I guess they're the sort of trenchant comment on, like, male exceptionalism in politics especially, where, you know, you will always get further ahead. Yeah. Whereas you've got Don's wife, Kath, who's sort of like the steady, you know, just the thankless role of actually being the pragmatist.
Yeah.
During the whole thing. Yeah. And these two still get to like live it up and not confront their failures.
Yep. Yep. The, Kath's my favourite character, my favourite person in the movie. The women are split amongst the married couples who feel invisible and the younger, more adventurous women who don't feel tied to anyone. And, the married women eventually turn on each other, and it's Don's wife, Kath, who's furious with Jeannie for spending the money they lent. It's such an interesting scene because the women take on the burden of being grown-ups while the men just wallow in their drunken state. And, you know, because you brought up Kath, I feel like she's really the only grown up in the, in the movie.
And sadly, I guess, like, you know, no, I'm not saying this is definitely not everyone in the modern, you know, in 2022, but, you know, still know plenty of guys who would be, you know, basically completely helpless.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for like their wife, you know, leading, you know, actually having to take charge.
Yeah.
Because there's that, you know, there's still that vestige of that sort of like, yeah, the patriarchy persists.
Yeah.
And just dudes that just are fucking hopeless and revel in it.
Yeah, yeah.
Sadly.
Yeah. There's a level of catharsis for everyone involved once the night descends into one confrontation after another. You know, in summing up, how do you think this movie holds up today?
I'll tell you on May 22nd.
Right.
I'm going to have a Zoom party, I think, it'll be completely different.
Yeah.
I mean, I haven't been to an election party for a long time, but like the politics are, I mean, if anything, like, you know, this is sort of feels like what it was like in 2007.
Yeah.
After 11 years of John Howard.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's that, you know, 2019 was going to be the year and that fell apart. And there's a, you know, again, the sort of, I don't think people are as pumped for this.
No.
Because, you know, as we've discussed, distance between the two parties is disappearing, and there's not much there for people who are genuinely struggling.
Yeah.
But it's still, the issues are all very still pertinent. Thankfully, a lot of them have gone away to some extent. But I, you know, that I'll divulge that Kevin Rudd party in 2007 was probably on par with Don's party.
Right.
Less fisticuffs, but definitely on par for nudity and drug taking, not drinking.
Right. Right. Yeah.
So still had it.
Yeah. Great. I remember our party was not, there wasn't any nudity, but there was definitely a lot of,
some drag queen nudity too. So I've got extra points.
Oh yeah. Well, that's a little bit more fabulous. Look, I think the movie still holds up today. I think it can be kind of confronting for anyone who hasn't watched it before or hasn't watched it in a long time, because the women characters are treated badly. But to me, that is part of the satirical point that is going on throughout this movie. And it's easy to miss that just because the men get a lot of the action and the jokes, it's all the women who are the truth sayers in some way. So
I mean, here we are with like Brittany Higgins and like Grace Tame and like talking about these, you know, these entrenched issues in like the culture of the Australian Parliament as well, you know, that have been continually attempted to be swept under the carpet, but
yeah,
just, you know, there's more and more force behind this stuff now.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. And, this film finishes with Don's wife telling him to come to bed as he staggers about his home, lost in his own thoughts. I thought that was a great ending. Great choice. I'm actually rapt that you brought this up and suggested this. So I had not watched it in a long time.
Because the Zoom timer is the...
It certainly is. Yeah, it's wasn't that a fun thing to discover is now happening with these connections? Oh, we've got a time.
By the way, guys, you've got 5 minutes and 57 seconds left.
Yeah.
Use it as you will.
Before I let you go, your book Cheaper Skips has been getting not only great reviews, but you are selling a boatload of them, and you must be wrapped with that.
Yeah, really happy with the response. Yeah, it's been out for about a month now, I guess. And yeah, some really interesting and fun people are reviewing it over on Goodreads because I have decided that the Lex Luthor's website is not for me.
Right.
So, full-heartedly, just selling it independently and seeing how that works, which is going well.
Yeah.
And, yeah, happy to see the response. And it's definitely opening up a few doors for the next project, which I think I will save to talk about in the episode to come, maybe.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. It's all really positive, and I'm really grateful for all the response that's been so far. Yeah. And if you just want to check anything out, just hit up my I'm at the pass the ammo on Instagram, Twitter.
Yeah.
And you can find the links from there for the book.
Yeah, great. No, I'm glad it's going really well, and the
it's been a lot of fun.
yeah. Some of those quotes that you're getting from people are really impressive.
It's pretty hilarious. And I'm also doing just to get back into the groove of writing for the next thing. I'm doing like weekly reads of a work in progress too on Instagram that drop on Tuesdays. They're a bit raunchier.
Yeah, great.
A bit naughtier, but they're good fun. So that's sort of just getting me in the habit of doing that sort of stuff and being a bit more face on camera too. So that's pretty hilarious. Yeah.
And for everyone listening, this is the first podcast that we've recorded with you in New Zealand. And a big shout out to New Zealand internet because this has been the best
China
that we've had.
Huawei, I think, is the internet provider, and they've done a great job.
They've done a great job. This is the clearest it's been. And you are much further away, so
very impressive. So that's a shout out to Malcolm Turnbull and Tony Abbott as well, and a big high five to Rupert Murdoch for deciding he wanted to get his Foxtel subscriptions up in 2013.
Oh yeah, isn't everything great, Garth? Thank you so much, and I look forward to whatever's next on Pass the Ammo.
Cool. Bye.
Thanks to Garth for joining me today, and make sure you head to our Facebook page to check out his new book, Cheaper Skips. I've left, that's at the Big Squid Facebook page. I've left a link there so you can click on that. I'll be back next week with Ben Elwood as we get back to Space Podyssey. We haven't had a Space Podyssey for a while, and it's a two-parter. We cover the original Planet of the Apes. In the meantime, if you'd like to support this podcast, head over to patreon.com/JustinHamilton_BigSquid or leave us a top review at Apple Podcasts. And also, if you'd like to check out my blog, Dispatches from the Fury Road, head over to BigSquidPod.com. That is BigSquidPod.com, and you can find all the recent ones there. I hope you enjoyed this podcast. And and thank you for all the kind words about the Doctor Strange podcast. There's a lot of you imploring us to keep going, with the Marvel movie. So that was a lot of fun to record, and we're rapt that you enjoyed it so much. So thank you for all the messages. And, you know, if you enjoyed the movie, that's great as well. Like, there's nothing wrong with that. It's good that you enjoyed it. We just didn't. Hence the fury. It's been kind of two angry podcasts in a row. Maybe that's the new norm over here. Anyway, thank you once again. Until then.